Welcome to Out There with TJ Ryan. It's strange. It's unusual. It's mysterious. It's out there, out there, out there, out there. And now your host, TJ Ryan.
He's like a brother. I think we may have, who knows what the connection is with Frank Fascino and myself, but I like Frank. I get along with him. I get his sense of humor, and he's a pretty amazing fellow. He's been covering Flatwoods Monster for over 20 years. It's an incident that took place in 1952. We'll go over that a little bit. Frank's down in Daytona Beach or that area in Florida, somewhere in that neck of the woods. How you doing, Frank?
I'm doing good. Great to be back, TJ.
It is nice to talk to you. So you just told me you had a monsoon move through down there.
Yeah, we got about 6 inches of rain overnight, and the Port Orange, Daytona area is basically pretty flooded bad. It's like the most rain we've got basically in a single day in a long time.
So what do you think's going on? Is this global warming?
Hey, maybe. I don't know. This has no connections to a hurricane either. That's what's kind of weird. We're supposed to get whacked with some more rain later. So we're in a good time slot right here to get the show done in between storms.
Maybe there's just some earth changes going on, Frank.
Definitely.
So you have been following, how long have you been following the Flatwoods Monster incident reporting?
It's about 22 years now.
And this is the 62nd anniversary of what? Right? 1952.
That's correct. Yep, September 12th, 1952.
And so most people probably know, if they've been listening to my show, they know a little bit about this story. But what's kind of a condensed version of what happened?
Well, during the summer of the saucers, Project Blue Book had recorded more UFO sightings during 1952 than any other year in history. And the summer of 1952, June, July, August, and September, there were 1,134 reports sent to Blue Book. They were in charge of the evaluation and research of the flying saucers. And there was 111 unknowns out of the 1,134 reports. And that whole year was the record year for reports sent to Blue Book. There was 1,501 reports.
And so the incident that you referred to was an incident that took place in Flatwoods, West Virginia.
Right, in the end of September.
And what happened? There was a craft that came in. It looked like it apparently had been shot at, or somehow it had been crippled. Something happened to it.
There was a damaged craft that flew in over the little town of Flatwoods, which is the central part of West Virginia, located in Braxton County. And there was a bunch of kids playing football on the elementary school playground, and they saw this thing coming from the northern part of the state, heading over the nearby mountain. It passed over their heads and made a 45-degree angle turn, flew over the school playground across the street, and it landed on the back property of a small mountaintop just on the other side of town.
So what happened is a few of the kids, they went and got an adult, and that was, what was her name, Mrs.?
Kathleen May.
Kathleen, Mrs. May.
Yeah, and Mrs. May. Two of her boys were within that group.
And so there was like six kids and her, right? Is that what it was altogether?
Well, Mrs. May had two boys.
Right.
And the rest of the kids that were involved in it, some of them had actually went home.
Oh, I see.
Some of them stayed. Some of them kind of chickened out. But in the end, there was Mrs. May, Gene Lemon, Neil Nunley, Teddy Neal, Eddie May, his brother Fred, Ron Shaver, and there was a six-year-old who had actually joined the group. He wasn't on the playground. His name was Tom Heyer. So we have two adults, Mrs. May and Gene Lemon, and then we have boys from 6 to 14 years old. So at this point, to go on the record, there was actually 8 witnesses
who were
involved in the Flatwoods Monster incident up on the farm. But, you know, back on the playground, there was a whole bunch of kids.
So when they went up and saw this thing, what did they experience?
Well, first of all, they didn't know it had touched down on the back part of the property. Some of the younger kids thought it was maybe a meteor. The ones that didn't know that meteors don't make 45-degree angle turns and make soft landings up on the back of the property. Some of them thought it was a UFO, and, you know, there was kind of pandemonium. When all the boys running up to Mrs. May's house, they just busted in the front door screaming and yelling. Something had landed up on the back property. Now, Mrs. May's property is at the borderline area of the Bailey Fisher Farm where this thing touched down. They saw it land on the far, far back of the property, and they all gathered together, and they went up onto the farm. There was a couple dogs that had accompanied them. One of them was Gene Lemon, the adult boy. He had his dog up there with him. Freddie May, the May family dog, accompanied them as well. And then there was a dog from the neighborhood that just happened to be in the area, and it was a big collie dog. This thing was a good size, kind of like Lassie. Mm-hmm. That dog accompanied them on the trip up. So we had 3 dogs, 2 adult witnesses, and the rest were boys between 14 and 6 years old.
And so they saw what they believe. I mean, what did they see? I mean, there was a couple that saw a real good, they had a real good view of what happened.
Well, what happened, TJ, I'll give you a quick rundown of the area. When they got onto the farm, there was actually 3 different fields. The first field was a wide, open, flat pasture. The second field, it was a gully, and it was sloped down to the right-hand side. Along the left-hand side, there was a border, and it was a wooded area. And this whole area, as you got onto the first pasture, actually was inclined and went straight up back towards where the third field was, and that was where the small mountaintop was. Now, it's important here to bring up, this was a cleared, wide-open area where this thing had touched down. It actually stopped in midair, and then it dropped towards the ground. So we have the first field, second, and third where it had touched down. Well, what had happened, TJ, in the meantime, by the time the boys got from the playground, went up the road to Mrs. May's home, they gathered. Mrs. May and Lemon got their flashlights because it was starting to get dark. They went onto the field. Mrs. May told me in one of the interviews, out in the back pasture area, she saw something flare up. It was like a purplish red flare. She saw this thing flash up from a distance. She couldn't see what it was because they were just about at the crest of the hill. And what had happened is this craft that had touched down on the back part of the property, it had actually relocated, hovered, and dropped into the gully of the second field. And at the back portion of that field, there were pear trees, and it kind of nestled itself in the back there. And by talking with the different witnesses I had worked with over the years, some of the boys had seen this large, it was like a oval-type craft sitting way out in the distance, and some of them didn't. And basically what I was able to establish is that because there was bushes that went up along the fence lines in between the areas where the property was divided, some of the boys could see up higher above this, the tree line was like a hedgerow, and some of them couldn't.
And so ultimately they saw what they thought, some of them saw this being in some kind of apparatus, suit?
Right. What had happened, I'll just pick up with the story here for continuity, TJ. When the group got to the borderline area between the first and second field, there was a big fence there with a gate. and it was a big, like a cattle gate. It was made out of steel. When they all got to that area there, they opened it up and they all passed through. The collie went out ahead. The May dogs were mixed in the group. Mrs. May and Lemon were leading the group. They passed through this area of the gate. They closed it behind them because there would be cattle and horses up there that would graze periodically, you know, throughout the year. So being good country people, you never leave the gate open.
Right.
They passed through this area. Now they're on this gravel path, TJ, and the people up there told me it was actually called the wagon path. It was like a wagon trail. And it starts to incline up, and there's various turns in this path. In the long run, what they wanted to do was to go up to the far back. Now, it's quite a climb. I've been up there dozens of times. You could get out of breath walking this path. They're looking straight all the way in the back. That's where the boy saw it touch down. They hadn't realized it had actually relocated. Because some of the boys, too, they thought it was a meteorite that had touched down. They didn't know any better.
Right.
So what happened is they're looking straight up ahead. In the meantime, the big collie dog had darted off and ran straight ahead of the group. And at this point, as they're pushing on, going up the inclination, there was a sulfur-type smell that started rolling down. It was a foggy mist, and that started rolling down as the group started walking into it. And at this point, the group, some of them started getting nauseous. They started pushing on. The dog disappears in the midst of this fog, and a few seconds later, it lets out a horrendous yelp and bark, and it starts carrying on a racket. It turns around, and it hightails back and goes running past the group and runs back towards the path, down the path back to the house. Then at this point, they start moving a little bit deeper up into this area where the woods are on the left, and they're walking into this fog. And at that point, Mrs. May and Lemon were leading the path with Neil Nunley, Eddie Shaver, Ron Shaver and Ed May. They came up to the second obstacle, and this was a wooden fence, TJ. At this wooden fence, it didn't open. It was about 3 to 3.5 foot high, and the slats were nailed from post to post. The posts are still there, but the slats are down basically at this point. Mrs. May, Lemon Nunley, Eddie May, and Ron Shaver climbed over this wooden fence, and they start proceeding a little bit further up. Lemon's dog, Freddie May's dog, Freddie May, Ted Neal, and Tommy Heyer, the little six-year-old, they were at the end of the path, the wagon train, you could say. They were all following each other up. They had just reached that fence and were about to climb over it. As May and Lemon started moving up a little bit closer, there was this oak tree. It was over 100 foot tall. It was a white oak tree, and it was set about 4 foot off to the left of the path. And they heard noises coming from this area of the tree. Mrs. May said it sounded like bacon frying in a skillet. It was like crackling.
Mm.
There was heat in the area, and Mrs. May said she also heard this low thumping noise. It was like a rhythmic noise. And her exact quote was, she said, it sounded like a silver dollar being bounced on a stretched canvas. Hmm. So you have this low thumping noise. They look up, and about 12 feet up in the air, they see these two eyes. Hmm. And they were in a dormant state. Lemon is following Mrs. May. They pushed up towards the tree to get a closer look. Now, this tree being set back and up a slope, it was a little bit darker in that portion of the woods. So they both simultaneously flashed their flashlights up. They thought it was an animal sitting up in a tree. It's about 12 foot in a limb. Well, that's where they got the shock of their life when the beams of their flashlights hit the area of the eyes. This thing lit up and glowed from the interior, and it hovered out, and it was a tall, 12-foot-tall metallic structure, and that's what was called the Flatwoods Monster. It hovered towards them, and at that point, it was realized that the sulfur smell was actually coming from a pipe system, which were like exhausts that went around a lower circumference of this craft, because that's what it actually was, TJ. Mm-hmm. It was a small hover-type craft. It moved in front of Mrs. May, and as it passed in front of Lemon, it was going across the path from left to right, and Lemon just kind of momentarily passed out. He fell over onto his back. Mrs. May was standing there looking at this thing, and she told me she got within the distance of a small car. So this thing pretty much almost came out on top of her. Now, what is really cool, TJ, is when I was working with the witnesses over these several years, another point I'm going to bring up, I didn't interview them just once. I talked to them countless times over the years.
Right.
And as I was putting together my timeline, trying to figure out who was where on the path, excuse me, and trying to figure out the whole layout of the property, Mrs. May was that close to the monster, and I was able to get good close-up descriptions of it from up close. I worked with Freddie very close, too, because Mrs. May and Freddie at that time, they had lived close to each other, so I was always going back over to their homes and back and forth with Freddie, and we would go see Kathleen. And the point I'm getting at is Freddie had reached that second gate, so he actually saw everything unfold in front of him from a distance. Mrs. May was basically, this thing was almost right on top of her. So when as I was doing the sketches, being an illustrator, I did police-style renderings of what this thing looked like.
Mm.
And I got the layout of the property. Then Freddie, as I started working a little bit closer with him, he actually took me up to the spot. And he worked with me step by step. We actually started on the school playground, and he explained what happened there with the boys. Then we went to the house, and we worked our way right up, and I videotaped the whole thing. And some of that interview you could actually see on YouTube, which is linked to my website.
I've seen that before. And it's really amazing because you talk to most of the people that when they were still alive, some of them have passed away, but you were able to get to a lot of the witnesses before they passed away.
Right. And at that point, being able to, that's when the story really pulled together for me, is when Freddie took me step by step. Kathleen was too old at that point. She couldn't make the trip because, believe me, it's quite a hike getting up there and going to the back. And Freddie even continued up to the tree. It was step by step by step. We took measurements because when I was writing the book, I wanted to get everything as close to reality as possible.
Frank, let me just stop you there for a moment. Now, those of you that have heard this before, and hopefully you have, because we talk about this every 6 months to a year, Frank saw it, and he's got his website, which is flatwoodsmonster.com, right? That's the website?
That's correct.
He has been 20-some years talking to so many different people, writing a couple different books, one called Shoot 'Em Down and then The Flatwoods Monster. And it's basically research is what it is. But we have come to the conclusion, well, at least we've drawn maybe some potential of what it could be. Now, we know that there was some craft. You were able to track this craft, this one craft that came into Virginia. And it was West Virginia, and it went through several different locations all throughout the course of that 24-hour period. Was it 24 or 48 hours?
There was 21 hours of sustained sightings that, in the long run, I had discovered that had occurred. The Flatwoods event actually picked up and at about 7:30, it was about 7:25 when that craft actually touched down. But what I did, TJ, is I worked in reverse. I worked on a gigantic master map, and that was an accumulation of sightings that I had put together because I, in the long run, figured out there was well over 100 sightings within these 21 hours, and a chunk of them took place in about a half an hour to 40 minutes. And when I worked in reverse after plotting these points, I discovered this thing had come over the eastern seaboard, passed over Washington, D.C., and the New York Times reported an article called The Flame Over Washington. And this flame was actually the Flatwoods Monster craft. I pinpointed this craft going across portion of Washington, and at some point it was actually hitting treetop level, which is pretty scary. This craft continued west, and it flew about 206 miles past over Virginia. It was seen by Virginians, passed into West Virginia, hit the northern portion of Braxton County, and actually redirected and turned south. And as it came down into the Flatwoods area, that's where the boys saw it on the playground. So nobody in the past had really done an in-depth investigation to figure out where this craft came from. I knew it had to come from someplace. It was just working in reverse.
Right. Now, you said
that's why the maps are so important.
You said, Frank, that that was just one of many that
right.
came over the eastern seaboard that night. And we also discussed that there was many different types of craft. It wasn't the same. Each one was different, or several were different. Let's put it that way.
Right. That's correct.
And so you also were able to uncover, to get further down the road, you were able to uncover that there was a order given to shoot these things down. Obviously, they were coming and checking on what we were doing. At least it appeared that way.
Right. It was about 6 weeks before that the Air Force had revealed that if you couldn't talk the flying saucers down, to shoot them down.
And so we lost, you told me, as I recall in one of our interviews, we lost more pilots in that time period than we did during the Korean War. Was that what this
Right, in the early 50s, right.
Okay.
That's correct. That's I worked with my database was the New York Times, and between 51 and 56, there was a lot of missing planes, mysterious crashes. A lot of these guys were World War II and Korean aces.
Yeah, and a lot of them never were found, were they?
That's correct, including the two airmen that disappeared on September 12th. Jones and Del Curto, they disappeared into thin air.
You think those were the ones? Were those the ones that were chasing the craft that went to Flatwoods?
No. This took place down over the Gulf of Mexico near Florida.
Okay.
What I started to say before, we had 21 hours of UFO sightings, and they occurred over 10 East Coast states. And this is some of the information in my latest book. And I'll give you a quick rundown. The sightings occurred over Delaware, Maryland, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Virginia, D.C., West Virginia, and South Carolina. And it's interesting because a good chunk of my information actually came from Project Blue Book, TJ.
Mm-hmm.
It took me several years to go through these documents, pull all the information out. And there was intelligence reports and tentative observers questionnaires, which basically were eyewitness accounts in explicit detail of what they had seen, what direction it was. They drew pictures, you know, the whole ball of wax. They gave their accounts. The only thing you couldn't find is where the names were blacked out, because you weren't supposed to track down and talk to these people.
Mm-hmm. But you did. You were.
Right.
And
so
it was
in the long run, we actually, I was able to establish that there was four damaged UFOs that accounted for 13 crash landings. And this is all pinpointed and documented in the book. I used, like I said before, I used a lot of the documents from Project Blue Book, which were all the official documentations of the sightings. And then I went into the regions where these sightings occurred, and I started contacting newspapers up and down the East Coast, and then I traveled to a lot of these states and actually went in, and I pulled all this stuff off of microfilm. And over the past couple of years, since I've been picking up speed and doing more interviews, the listeners have actually been contacting me and mailing me and emailing me further they've been noticing me of further locations where these sightings occurred. So it's ongoing. So I just keep adding more sightings and connecting the dots. But the main structure of what happened is there were three damaged UFOs that came over the eastern part of the United States, over the eastern seaboard. The first one headed towards Oak Ridge National Laboratory. It made a beeline, and it headed directly southwest. And it flew about 100 miles or so into the no-fly zone of Oak Ridge, which is a no-no. You're not supposed to be flying that close to a security-sensitive area. The second craft flew northwest, and it flew over Baltimore, and then I tracked it going right up towards Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. The third object came straight down the middle and threaded the needle, you could say, and passed over Washington, D.C. When that object passed over Washington and continued west, when it got a ways past Washington into the Virginia area, the other two objects moved and relocated. The one that was headed towards Oak Ridge actually touched down. The other one turned away and went up towards the Wheeling, West Virginia area. So when that thing passed safely over D.C., it was not intercepted because it had flown through the security zone where you're not supposed to fly. The other two backed off. So basically, we had a strategy there. The fourth object came up from the southern area, from the area of Florida, and it flew into the area of Flatwoods and actually went over the Bailey Fisher Farm where the other one had touched down. But at this point of the story, the Flatwoods Monster craft had not touched down. It was actually a rendezvous point.
It was. And really?
Yes. Yeah, they were, those two damaged, they were the two most severely damaged crafts. And what had happened is that was a rendezvous point. Then all the other crafts came in looking for it. That's why when you, I looked into the original research of Ivan T. Sanderson and of Gray Barker, they couldn't figure out why there were so many different descriptions of the Flatwoods Monster craft. Everybody just thought there was one craft. Well, it wasn't one. It was a search party, and I tracked the search party crafts coming in, which was, it's an unbelievable story. Some of the vets that I've worked with, TJ, the military guys, they just stood back and they looked at my map and their jaws hit the ground. And on my Flatwoods Monster site, if you scroll down a little bit on the homepage, TJ, you'll see an area where it says quick links. And if you click on the appearances, you could go and see all the stories and the updated stories and pictures. I have new photographs of my master map. And if you come into the September area, right on that page, you'll find the story Flatwoods Monster movie and the other one that has the updated photos of my map. It's called The Flatwoods Monster Incident and UFO Wave of September 1252. And that is my most recent updated map. And you could actually see it with your own eyes and see the activity that was going on. There was actually 25 different UFOs I was able to decipher that were over the United States that day.
That same day. And now,
yes.
Do you know if there was another day? Because I was just going to ask you this. Was there another date or time where that happened again, where there was a swarm of craft like that?
Not to this magnitude.
Okay.
Yeah, so, I had talked to Stan Friedman about this, and as far as we know, there's nothing of this magnitude where I was able to actually track and, you know, make time stamps and make flight path trajectories.
You know, and the funny thing is, people that have never heard this before are going to say, well, how come I never heard of this? And it's like,
right.
Did this make the national and world press at all?
It was the 10th biggest news story of the world, as far as I know. It, you know, it hit different presses and different media sources, but the United Press had covered it extensively. But what happened is it turned into a folklore tale because everybody started making fun of the West Virginians. And even though there was multiple witnesses, they were kind of like, this is kind of ridiculous, because what happened is Mrs. May Jean Lemon and Ailey Stewart Jr., who was a reporter that broke the story to the press. They went to New York the following week, September 19, 1952, and they appeared on a television show called We the People. And a sketch artist sat down with Mrs. May and Lemon, and they asked what this thing looked like. And to make a long story short, the artist screwed it up, and he misinterpreted what this thing looked like, and he made it into a monster with scary claws and big arms that waved around, and he had it in this type of a hood that came to a point, and it looked like a monk's robe outfit with a pleated lower portion. And he just screwed the whole thing up. That was shown on national TV that day, and in the history books, they just kept using that same stupid picture over and over and over again. And nobody could figure out why a monster wearing a garment was hovering. Well, when Mrs. May was trying to describe to the sketch artist the lower portion of the torso of this thing, it actually flared out. This thing was metallic. And the pipes that went around a lower circumference, that was the actual likeness of what it was. It was part of an exhaust system, and that made this thing hover. And that's why when the witnesses saw this thing, there was the confrontation. It lifted up, and it hovered towards him. And if you look in the original sketch, TJ, you'll see the drop cast shadow that's underneath the monster that is a representation of it hovering. And nobody could figure out, why is a monster in a skirt hovering? Because it wasn't a skirt. They were pipes. Freddie May told me when I was sitting in his living room a few years ago and we were going over doing the sketches, he said the pipes were metallic and they were about as thick as your forearm. And I remember he held his forearm up. He said that's about how big the pipes were. So that was part of an exhaust system, and the sulfur smell was the fog. Right. And that was being billowed down the path, and they walked into it. That's why the closer they got towards this thing, it was a little bit more thicker, and the smell became worse because it wasn't dissipating.
You've done this one way. I mean, so many different ways. You've interviewed so many different people. So there's no question about the documentation, Frank. I think anybody that looks at your work, you don't have to explain it, Frank. You really don't. I know you pick out all the facts and you get it exactly right, but we've covered this enough to where we know. I want to move a little further because we have things to get to as well. And I wanted to, you and I both speculated, I guess we can't prove this, but we felt that this was like an intervention or somebody was coming to keep an eye on us because didn't you tie this together with that the military was doing some kind of maneuvers?
The day before there was sightings, okay? The day after was when Operation Mainbrace started. And if you know, that's a whole ball of wax in itself. They were operations that took place with different countries, and they were mock maneuvers. It was like a mock maneuver war. And when I had talked to Stan Friedman about this and brought this point up, he said, put yourself in the shoes of the aliens. He said, they're up above looking down, and they're looking at basically a war going on. It was a pretend war.
Mm-hmm.
Operation Mainbrace, and there were lots of UFO sightings there as well.
Well, you know, if you go back, Frank, if you go back to World War II, and remember the Foo Fighters, and they saw those not just in Germany or over in Europe, but didn't they also see them in the Pacific, the Asian area?
Yeah. Yes.
And these crafts, who was keeping an eye on things? Was somebody keeping an eye on? I think it was.
Absolutely. And the point that Stanton brought up is on September 12th, the maneuvers hadn't officially started till the 13th, but all of the vessels and aircraft were maneuvering into position at that point. So you see all of this stuff from above. It looks like another war starting. It wasn't. They were mock wars.
I think, you know, people might say, well, how come... if these things have come to see us before or to keep an eye on us, maybe they're here to keep us from destroying ourselves, why didn't they show up before? Well, they've been in our history before, but after the invention, I think, of nuclear weapons is kind of what got their attention. Do you think that, Frank?
I really do. That's when the sightings had peaked. And Major Donald Keough, United States Marine, retired. He was a pioneer UFO researcher back in the 40s and 50s, and he wrote some unbelievable books. And he actually did a nice long study how all these UFOs were showing up over security-sensitive military installations. They were showing up over nuclear areas. They were showing up over Air Force bases, NAS. You know, they were showing up where they shouldn't be. And they were actually penetrating the zones here. And Keough wrote extensively about it. And he started plotting the points, and he writes about it in one of his books. And these UFOs were watching all these key areas.
Yeah, and they still are today. You know, you still hear about stories about that today. And even if you want to look beyond that time period, even Vietnam, I've heard many vets talk about unidentified craft over in Vietnam. So you wonder if that kind of goes on in a lot of military events.
It was going on during the Korean War, too. There was a lot of sightings over Korea as well. And, basically from World War II right through all the way up till now, I talk to guys on book tour who have been in, you know, the Mideast who have seen stuff.
Yeah, it's amazing. And the American public does not know because the press does not cover this. They did at one time. Don't you think the press was more honest about the way they covered things when TV first came around and radio had not been around that long? And there wasn't the blackout that we seem to have now. And if something was released, like Roswell, then they quickly changed the story.
That's true. And leading into this next point I was going to raise, it's kind of interesting. The show We the People originally started out as a radio show. Then it turned into a television show, and it was aired for quite a few years. After Mrs. May went on television with Stewart and Gene Lemon, and they showed this Flatwoods Monster on national television, and it was seen by a lot of people. Millions had seen this. Now, you have to remember, this was during the summer of the saucers, and these saucers were being sighted basically every day across the United States. There wasn't a lot of coverage on this stuff, but in the newspapers, there was quite a bit. On the radio and television, not that much, but the papers were picking it up. And what happened is after May and Lemon and Stewart were on the TV show, there was only one more show of We the People broadcast, and then the show was canceled.
Really?
Another coincidence, because here you go, you know, the summer of the saucers, people are freaked out. Just a few weeks before, you have the shoot down orders that hit into the press. It was talked about in a press conference by Ramey, and then we have the Washington sightings back to back on the 19th, 20th, and the 26th and 7th. And then a few weeks later, we have this thing touching down in Flatwoods. What nobody had done to the extent I did was look outside of Flatwoods in omnidirections. And that's when I started really getting involved into the case, because I knew there was more than just that little monster sighting. That was only a portion of it. When I started going north, south, east, and west, that's when I found out that there was 116 locations where these UFOs were seen.
Frank, if this happened back in 52, and we think it's still going on, how come there haven't been more interactions with our military firing on these craft and you know, I know throughout history we've had jets that have just crashed, even in the modern era. Something, right. They were chasing after something. But we haven't seen these crafts. It's like we can't hurt them at all. Their technology now is so advanced that they can just, like, take off. and spins circles around us. Like in 1952, it's like their technology, maybe with some of these crafts, just wasn't as advanced? Or why is there such a difference?
Maybe it was just this one particular race of beings that they didn't have, you know. Maybe they didn't have the armaments on them that the other crafts wouldn't have to destroy. I don't know, but all I know is that I was able to track four of them coming in damaged. At that point, the Air Defense Command was using rockets, TJ, and the rockets were just unveiled and made public in July, right around the time of the D.C. sightings, the back-to-back weekends. So as I've talked with several different vets and Stanton Friedman about this, is that would have been a hell of a surprise to a bunch of alien craft who knew where the drop-off rate, what the drop-off rate of the bullets coming at them was, just to stay out of harm's way. All of a sudden, bang, here's the Air Defense Command, and they got 2.75-inch Mighty Mouse rockets they're firing at them. And they went a lot further, and they were actually loaded with TNT, and they could do a lot more damage. That would have been a nice surprise towards them.
So we could have possibly caught them off guard, and then in the future, you know, maybe they obviously had more advanced. There's certainly now, you look at the UFOs of what they can do nowadays, how they can be gone in an instant. They can
right. They
can fly in and stop and then take off at thousands of miles, basically the speed of light, it seems like, and be gone.
Right. But you don't see that many sightings or reported sightings of these particular types of craft that much anymore. Because what was seen that night, they were basically, they looked like big eggs or footballs.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the crafts were round. I got pretty good detailed descriptions of what these things look like. You don't see or hear that much about these anymore. Maybe they realize, oh, we're not going to that planet. They're hostile.
You said there were several other, there was more than one different type of race or craft that was here, right?
There was also the cigar-shaped objects that were gigantic.
Okay.
And then there was a round type craft. Then there was a gigantic oval craft like the Flatwoods craft. And I was only able to pick up an actual flying disc saucer in one location.
Okay.
So it seems that there was a bunch of different ones, but the majority of them were the oval-shaped ones. They look like big giant eggs or a football, and a couple of them were round.
So we've kind of come to, you know, I'm guessing you watched Star Trek when you were a kid. Or at one time in your life?
Not too much. I wasn't a big science fiction fan,
right,
or
but,
a Trekkie or anything,
but
I'm familiar with them.
The premise of that and other TV shows is that there is a group or a federation of beings that work together for the betterment of the universe. I don't think that's too far-fetched. And what you've uncovered with this seems to support that. You have all these different groups, different types of ships, and they seem to be working. Well, I mean, they could have come in if their advanced technology, they could have just wiped us out. And they could do that now. They could easily do that now. And they don't. So that's good. That's always good. And the thing is, it appears that they're observing, and people I've interviewed over the years have told me. And one remarkable story is an interview I did a couple of years ago. And it was an event that took place in 1987, and this man was abducted in Canada, and he was taken, Jim Maroney is his name, Jim was taken at a truck stop, not outside of Vancouver, and these were the Greys that took him with the big eyes, and when Jim was done with his, he was really terrified, and he was swearing at him a blue streak, and then he, under hypnosis, he remembered a lot of it. He even remembered consciously a lot of it. But under hypnosis, he remembered he was crying. He was crying when they left because they told him and sat down and explained why. And to him, he feels they were trying to prevent us from destroying ourselves. And there's been an intervention going on. And there are certain people that say this, that have, and this has happened many times, Frank, right?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Many people have come forward and said, I was taken. And some people say, well, they poked and prodded me and stuff like that. But there are those few that will say, they educated me and they were letting me know what happened. And they are here to help us. And I think that, I don't know what all of them are up to, but I certainly think there's a group that is trying to help us. And you feel that way as well.
Well, a few years ago, one of my book signings, a guy walked up to me, and he was actually from an Air Force. He was a retired Air Force guy, and he had read my Braxton County Monster book, and he had seen my master map, and because I brought that on different book tours over the years, and he looked at it, and he said, what it looks like happened here with this search and rescue mission that went on is there was a primary group of UFOs, and these objects were the oval or round-shaped ones. When something went awry and these things got hit and they all went down, it's like the rest of them came in and assisted to help them. And he says, I think that's what accounts for the rest of the sightings, because the initial sightings were just the oval or round-shaped crafts. And if you look at my master map on my website, you will see it's pretty detailed how all the roads lead to Flatwoods. And then there was another rescue mission that took place up in the Wheeling, West Virginia area, and that occurred just after the Flatwoods incident, and there was another being that was found up there dead. And that's the one called Bashful Billy. It was found in the Wheeling area. And for 2 hours, it was reported from the Pittsburgh area and the eastern Ohio and the whole valley area and the northern panhandle area of West Virginia was bombarded with what they called a meteor shower. Now, they're looking into this without making a whole program out of it. There were no meteors or meteor showers or meteorite landings in the United States that night. That's pretty easy to figure out. The only place where it was reported it was a meteor was by Project Blue Book. Mm. That was their official. This whole thing was called the well-known Washington area meteor.
So
even though there was 21 hours of sightings, the 116 locations over 10 states, how could all that be blamed on one meteor that was seen for 5 to 6 seconds?
Well, you know, there's a formula that they use, and I've seen it because I've studied a lot of it as well over the years, and it's like something happens, people report about it, eventually it dies down, eventually they change the truth completely, it's removed from any kind of history, and we forget about it. That's why Flatwoods Monster, one of the biggest events ever in this country, and the most researched event by you, Frank. And when you first told me about this, I thought you were nuts. I thought, really? Where does he get to? And I'm sure you, honestly, I'm just kidding. I'm open to all things. But I thought, really? How come I never heard of this? This is a huge event. And because it happened quite a while ago, and because these kind of things are removed, if they do make it into media, they are completely removed. And eventually people die off. And people are afraid to talk about it too, aren't they, Frank?
Well, that's kind of what happened. Once this whole thing hit the media with that ridiculous drawing of the monster, and the story just went out of control. And the press and the different people talking about it, the whole thing turned into a folklore. And that was kind of what the whole thing that the government wanted this thing to turn into was a folklore tale. And what had happened is the locals became so frustrated and teed off over this thing, they just shut down. They said, screw this, we're not going to talk about this. First of all, with the monster, the description of it, you know, and what it was shown on television, and the locals just shut up. It wasn't easy trying to bust into this
area. If any of these people were threatened or told not to talk about things?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, they were. Mrs. May told me a couple intelligence officers were up there, and they posed as newspaper reporters. I go pretty in-depth into it. What I had to do is I took all of my interviews with all the witnesses, and I transcribed them, and I put them verbatim quotes into the book. Some of them I have audio, some are video, and that is what's in my most recent book. And then I have newspaper accounts that have come out of the woodwork that people have informed me about, and I just keep piling more evidence and evidence and evidence. I basically know what went on that entire day within a few minutes, especially around what was going on in Flatwoods. The people wouldn't talk to me at first, and I thought it was kind of rude. Then a little bit further I got into it, then I understood why the people shut down, because they were just tired of being made fools out of.
Absolutely. I see that with paranormal. You know, doing my show, people are afraid to come forward, even if they just have a ghost or whatever. And we're all afraid to speak our truth because we don't know we're going to be made fun of, even locally amongst our friends and people we know. Not so much even the press, but that kind of thing. So I can see how that people would go inward. Frank, you said when I talked to you recently that you talked to a new witness, somebody was a young boy at the time?
Yes. That was in Strange Creek. That was at the beginning of the year, and we haven't went into that since our last interview.
Yeah, what happened with this fellow? Now, where's Strange Creek connected to Flatwoods?
Okay, Flatwoods is the geographical center of the state, just southwest of the area of Flatwoods is Frametown. And I just want to touch on this because this is important, TJ. Frametown is the area where the Flatwoods Monster craft and the being itself, it took off from Flatwoods and flew about 17 miles southwest and touched down and landed in Frametown. Okay, Strange Creek is just 4 miles south of Frametown. And earlier this year, I got a phone call, and it was from this man who had actually witnessed the Flatwoods Monster, but he saw it in Strange Creek at 3 a.m. in the morning on September 13th, which was just a few hours. The Flatwoods encounter took place at 8. So we have 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 1, 2, 3. 7 hours later, he saw this. And at the time, he didn't know what he had seen. And then moving into the future a little bit, when everything was shown on TV and the monster was described with this the cloth outfit, it didn't make sense to this kid. And throughout, you know, his childhood in school and talking to him and his family about it, he had actually described the Flatwoods Monster partially out of its suit with the upper portion of the helmet and inner helmet removed. And that's what this thing was. It was different portions of a suit. You had the lower portion where the pipes were, the upper portion narrowed at the shoulders, and it was approximately 3 foot at the base and about 4 foot at the base and about 3 foot across the shoulders. Then it had this gigantic cowl, which was over the top of its head. What was described as the face of the monster was actually an inner helmet with porthole eyes. What this fella had seen as a kid, he actually saw the Flatwoods Monster with the inner helmet and outer helmet removed.
So he saw the real being.
Yeah, he saw the area of this thing removed. When you moved to later on that night, about 8 o'clock on September 13th, in Frametown, which is just about 4 miles away, that's where this pieces into the George Natowski incident, where the guy was with his wife and baby and the car stalled on the side of the road, and he got out to go see what was going on. He tried to start his car. It wouldn't start. The area was filled with, once again, a sulfur-type smell, and he saw a UFO hovering out in the woods that was purplish, like a purplish reddish color, like what Mrs. May had described. When he started moving out towards that area, that's when he encountered a being that was hovering with the lower portion was seen, except he saw the Flatwoods Monster from the waist up to the head, and it was a reptilian snake-like looking creature. And it had long spindly arms with a couple fingers at the end. It didn't have five digits, it had two. And it actually followed him back to the car and scared the living hell out of him and his wife.
I know.
He barricaded himself into the car. The wife, Edith, had grabbed the baby. What they had was, back in those days, no baby seats. The baby was actually in a crib in the back seat. She grabbed the baby. George pushed the wife and the baby down onto the floor and had pulled the wife out. And he was protecting his family. This thing had actually hovered around the car, got towards the front of it. George looked up through the windshield. It scared the hell out of him. There was this gigantic creature hovering at the front of his car, in front of the bumper and the hood, and it was looking down on him.
Oh, could you imagine?
Oh my God. That was actually scarier than the Flatwoods Monster incident, because he saw the true flesh and blood of the monster from the waist up.
And didn't it,
and it touched the hood of the car, and it burned a hole right through into the primer, right?
So
right through the
paint. This was like an acidic type being of some sort.
Yes, that's what it seems like.
And to burn a hole in his car just by touching it. Now, this was obviously not to hurt him, because it could have easily, again, it could have easily destroyed him, killed his whole family, but it was just curious, it sounds like, right?
Right. That's what it seems like. You know, we may never know, but that was a pretty scary encounter. And when I started piecing all of this together from what Freddie Mace had told me when we were on site, in Flatwoods, he said that he believed there was something inside of this. He said it was being controlled. And Mrs. May was of the same opinion. This thing was, some intelligence was controlling this thing. It didn't have eyes, TJ. Mrs. May and Freddie went into a good detail with it. Remember I told you he was back at the gate, the wooden piece?
Yeah.
He saw this thing, and when his mom and Jean hit it with the flashlight, it glowed from the inside, and what it actually did is the beams of light that came out weren't Buck Rogers' death beams. They were lights that were forced out from the inside of this apparatus, which was steel. And Freddie saw the beams actually shot over the top of the nearest witnesses' heads. So you have this upper torso area, then you have an outer helmet, and Freddie said that it was actually looked like a plate glass window in front of it. It wasn't open, it was like a windshield in front of it. And the inner helmet was actually red with portholes. That's where the beam shot out from. So now, the Statowski incident that happened about one day later in Frayntown, 17 miles away, I had tracked the Flatwoods Monster craft through local newspapers. I got my hands on some early reports. I used some of the past researchers' investigations when they had talked to people, and it actually landed on James Knob there. Now we have a witness who contacted me who didn't see the big cowl and he didn't see the inner helmet. So it looks like as time was going on, it was seen in the full suit on September 12th in Flatwoods. Then when it was seen in Strange Creek 7 hours later, the helmets were removed, and when it was seen later on that night by the Statowski family, the rest of it was removed from the waist up. But the one common thing, it was always seen in the lower portion of the suit with the pipes.
Kind of hovercraft that was also a combination suit that it could, like, take off part of it from the sound of it. Right,
and yeah, that's what that was its mode of transportation, was this lower suit.
So We have to move on because we're just about out of time. And I know you have so much, Frank, and you love talking about this because you've spent 22 years of your life. And I wish we had a six-hour show and then you could tell me everything. But tell me quickly about you filmed a movie. And whether or not this movie actually comes out, but it had something to do with the Flatwoods Monster, right?
I received a call last year, and it's from the producers of 701, the movie. And what 701 is, the amount of unknown or unexplained Project Blue Book cases that had occurred between, actually, Blue Book came about in 1951, late 51 up to 69. And it's all the cases and key cases that have to do with Project Blue Book. And the people out there had read my Braxton County Monster book, and they loved the story, and I was flown out to Hollywood, and I stayed out there for a few days. And I was interviewed by a couple different people, and they're working on putting this whole thing together. In the meantime, I have released to the public, I have my own movie treatment that I had been working on for years. Mm. And it's a detailed account of how I see the Flatwoods Monster movie. There's actually a Flatwoods Monster movie supposedly in production, but it seems that it's based more on fiction than fact.
Mm.
And it's some type of a horror movie. Your listeners could look it up online, which to me, I was never contacted to consult on anything. So the way I see it, if I wasn't consulted, this thing couldn't be too good.
No. You're not going to let that. So you have a screenplay that you've written, correct?
Yes, right. It's a treatment of how I perceive it, you know, with a very strong timeline.
And it's a musical, right, Frank?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I think I see something up the hill.
Yeah, too bad Fred Astaire wasn't alive, right?
Yeah. No, it's not. It's actually, you've kind of, you're telling a story with this, aren't you?
Yes, I am. Yeah, and it was actually, it's probably the best and easiest thing I ever wrote because I've never done anything like this before. And I just sat down. I knew I could do it. There's an article online that talks about this, of how it came about. But this has been on my agenda for years. And it wasn't as hard as I thought it was going to be. I basically sat down and wrote it in one shot. And then I went back in and I tweaked it and highlighted it, you know, going in, putting the icing and the cherry on top. But it's probably the best thing I ever wrote.
Now, well, you and I have talked about this, and I'm not going to obviously reveal really what's going on in here. But you're going to release, if when this comes forward, people are going to hear some things that are going to surprise them. That you've kind of been keeping in the background, right?
Yeah, they'll probably be shocked over it. But for the true listeners and followers of the Flatwoods case and what I've been doing for years, I don't think the true believers are going to be that shocked. But overall, the general public will be.
Right, because there's something that you're sitting on, and I wish we could talk about it, but I guess we'll have to wait on that, won't we?
Yeah, well, that's part of the surprise. But
I'm just
it's a phenomenal writing that I did. And hopefully somebody out there is listening, and I'm open to talking to production people about it. And I have everything sitting here just to go over with them if I get any phone calls. I've been getting a lot of, since the spring, TJ, I've been getting a lot of requests to do documentaries from all over the world. But I'm beyond the documentary stage. That thing I put up on YouTube that I worked with, basically that's the gist of the story. And I don't think a documentary is going to be able to top that too much. I have Colonel Levitt in there, who is the only known interview on the planet. He was the colonel from the United States Army who was called by Pentagon officials, and he was sent into Flatwoods. and he was there with about 50 troops, and he was there with a total of 180. There was another crash. One of the other damaged crafts went down, and he went up there with his group and cordoned off the areas, and that is on my documentary. So basically at this point, TJ, I'm kind of done with the documentaries. I did my own, so I don't really think there's a use to come out with anything to top mine. At this point, I want to pursue the avenue of a movie because it has all the makings for a movie.
And you know, movies are, even if they're based on a true story, there generally is some entertainment mixed in, right?
Right, of course. Yeah, you had the romance angle mixed in. Like I said to Al Lindbergh in that article, there's some romance in there. There's stuff about the missing pilots, which we could do 10 shows just about that case.
Mm-hmm.
But there's enough information on the internet, and the whole thing is in my book. That can be ordered on my website, flatwoodsmonster.com.
Well, Frank, I wonder who's going to play Frank Fascino in this movie. Are you going to play yourself?
I don't know. Maybe with your voice, you might be a good candidate.
I'll play Frank Fascino, the short version, the short Frank. When you're, they're going to have to put me, you know, from a distance, and I'll play you as a boy. How about that?
There you go.
Flatwoodsmonster.com if you want to learn more about this actual event, which took place 62 years ago. And the anniversary just celebrated recently on that. Frank, you do good work, and you're really thorough. That's the one thing. I know when I get you on the phone, you're going to tell me every detail. And I appreciate
it. Thanks for having me on the show, TJ.
Thank you very much, Frank.
All right.
Music on Out There, created by Kevin MacLeod.